We have Jason Magabo Perez with us tonight. Jason is the author of Phenomenology of Superhero, This Is for Mostless, and the volume you received an early copy of tonight. This isn't even available for sale quite yet. Is that
exclusive.
Right, Jason?
Exclusive.
Yeah. I ask about what falls away. Jason, his work has been featured nationally and internationally in many publications and in different venues, including the Interim Witness, the Feminist Wire, and NPR's Here and Now. He's the recipient of a Challenge America grant from the National Endowment for the Arts and is a previous artist in residence at the Center for Art and Thought. And is, as I said, spoken nationally, internationally, and here at home, La Jolla Playhouse and Los Angeles Contemporary Exhibitions. Perhaps most impressively, Jason is a triple alum of UC San Diego. He has an undergraduate degree in political science dating back to the early 2000s, a Master of Arts in Ethnic Studies, and a dual PhD, very impressive, in Communication and Ethnic Studies, as well as, you had to go get one more degree somewhere else, an MFA in Writing and Consciousness from the New College of California. So I guess one of my questions will be, what degree is next? I really hope Jason will share a few stories with us tonight about what he saw on campus and how he was involved on campus. I know you were very active when you were here. Jason is currently the Associate Professor and Director of Ethnic Studies at CSU San Marcos, so California State University San Marcos, where he is a Community Arts Fellow of the Bulsuan Center for Filipino Studies, Associate Editor for the Ethnic Studies Review, and a core organizer with the Digital Salsa. And, you know, one thing, again, I really want to learn from Jason or hear from Jason tonight is a little bit more about the role he currently has, we're so impressed with, is his Poet Laureate role for San Diego for 2023-24. And so with that just really impressive bio, Jason, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
So we're going to get started with Jason sharing a little work for us.
Yeah, I'm excited. Thank you very much for coming out. I'm glad to get a copy of the book Into the World to you. It is a strange feeling. I got here at 5 o'clock, and then I walked around and I got lost. But I do remember these walls. We have disrupted many meetings in this building as students and walked through. And I just remember one time, it felt like we were about to be blocked in, and someone climbed out of a window. And it's really, really great to be here. But I want to thank the library and all the sponsors for making this possible. I'm incredibly humbled to be here, to be back. I am a triple alumni. I think I've also just sort of been involved in, been a part of various communities connected to UCSD for a very, very long time. So much so that my partner and I, when we moved back to San Diego, we ended up in Claremont, right? So where those of us who can't afford to live in La Jolla move. Or Mira Mesa. I left my heart in Mira Mesa, by the way. There's a really long poem about Mira Mesa in the book. So, but I want to share some work from the book. It won't be too long, but I do... again, appreciate the folks who made this helped make this come together. Taylor Haglin and Eric and April and the team who brought everything together to make this happen. So I'll talk about the book a little bit more when we have a conversation, but I want to share some work. I want to start off with a bit of an epigraphic note, a way maybe to have a little bit of a moment of silence. I'm going to read a very, very short excerpt, a very short epigraph of this poem that was written in 2023 by the poet Hiba Abu Nada. Hiba Abu Nada was a novelist, a poet, and an educator. Her novel, Oxygen Is Not for the Dead, won the Sharjah Award for Arab Creativity in 2017. She wrote this poem, from which I will excerpt, I Grant You Refuge, on October 10th, 2023. She died a martyr, killed in her home in South Gaza by an Israeli raid on October 20th, 2023. She was 32 years old. So I want to read a short, as a sort of opening, as an epigraph, I want to read a very short piece, a very short excerpt from Hiba Abu Nada's poem. I grant you refuge from hurt and suffering. With words of sacred scripture, I shield the oranges from the sting of phosphorus and the shades of cloud from the smog. I grant you refuge in knowing that the dust will clear, and they who fell in love and died together will one day laugh. So this, I'm going to start reading from this book. This is a book length, it's one long poem. I'm going to jump around a little bit. Imagine the honesty of the dead. Imagine it pressing. Imagine water inside what gets remembered. What gets remembered inside the pinkish gray glow of an uncle's surgery scar. What scars from a life of being worked. This calm in excess of crisis in the backyard on the folding table rests around Tupperware of buko salad. There fly langau, langau everywhere, everywhere. These sorts of things migrate. These sorts of things thesis. These things make mess. An artist's guide, a queer genealogy going and going and going. Such mourning is discontinuous. And there goes uncle in a Sunday white Lakers jersey and gold watch and gold chain. And there goes auntie in a purple and gold swap meet starter's jacket. And there goes another auntie protecting the buko salad with a hospital blue shower cap. Call this raw material literature. Call this principled surrender. Call this grammar of worry. I draft this dear Kasama against fish hooks of hope. I draft against slow elimination. I draft from soft interior of riot. I draft syllables of known sadness, such knowing, such evidence, such kitchen table phenomenology of you reading this, of this reading you. On a rainy morning, I see you through the window in a blue mask and black hoodie, delivering bags of groceries at the doorstep. I draft from collected stillness, restless ghosts are archived in my veins. Consider this an intimate poetics of rage. Consider this rage divine refusal. Let us talk about such refusal. Let us talk about such dysregulation of promise. Let us talk about how much I miss you. Drive east on University toward 49th. Park your Civic in the alley out back. This alley of splendor and solitude, a gallery of rain-soaked mattresses. A child will slide down a half-assembled red plastic slide into a small hill of middle-grade paperbacks. You'll find a gold purse filled with fresh broccoli and blue rubber gloves. You'll find prayer at daybreak. This alley will smell of dank weed and brake dust. You'll find on the ground a black tote bag stuffed with wet lettuce and white surgical masks. It'll seem like this was dropped in a hurry. You'll wonder if that hurried person is safe. You'll notice a wire fence across the alley limp as the days go by. Swarms of flies will hover above plastic trash bins. Crows will cross the alley. Someone will keep claiming the telephone pole in blue spray-painted letters you'll never be able to decipher. Someone will be barbecuing carnitas y elote. On sunny days, dried lemon rinds will stick hard to pavement. One day, in front of your Civic, you'll find clean chicken bone wrapped in foil. Neighbors on the other end will party. You'll hear bottles clinking. Patrol cars will cram the alley for no good reason, and it'll smell of burnt plastic and cigarette smoke. You'll hear sirens. You'll hear laughter. You'll hear water drumming against trash bags full of aluminum cans. This will be an after party for afterlives. An elder neighbor will warn you of drugs and the devil's work, A crew of youth will hotbox an old pathfinder. On the rainiest days, this alley will be a shallow river. Weeds, shreds of paper, crow feathers, dried lemon rinds rushing downstream. Someone will break into your Civic. Someone will break into your Civic again. They will steal neither your surplus of Starbucks napkins nor your prized Blackstreet CDs. They will steal some old prescription eyeglasses and a broken pair of headphones. Yes, and there'll be the homie. Quiet, please. The homie will be sound asleep on that perfectly fine, barely faded, but discarded wooden dining chair. When you see the homie, please leave masks, please leave bottled water, please leave bags of ice, please leave a hot carne asada burrito, and please leave two toothbrushes, one for homie's teeth and one for homie's Jordan 1s. Place everything in plastic bags. Hang the bags gently on the handlebars of the homie's BMX. Shh. This sadness is a politics. This sadness knows. This sadness holds. This sadness, it wants, it warns, it warms. Sadness in the shadow of capital. Sadness against white supremacy. Sadness against imperialism. Sadness against tanks and tear gas. Sadness blocking killer cop kneecap near neck. Sadness that in fact is its own godforsaken solidarity statement. If you want to know what we are, melodramatic telenovela sadness, bulletproof sadness, clapback sadness, confessional sadness, abominous sadness, anti-colonial sadness, say, land back, say, all power to the people, say, I am the people, say, I am not the pig, say, makibaka, say, makibaka, say, junk anti-terror law, say, demilitarize, say, deoccupy, say, para todos, todos, say, la lucha se sigue, say, hasta la victoria, say, wagmatakot, say, isulong, say, inat, say, isangbagsak, say, sadness of my mother's and father's return from home to here, what could be a final return, sadness of departures, sadness of colonial removal, sadness of perpetual displacement. Such sadness is so Filipino. Such sadness is relational urgency. Such sadness is abolitionist sadness. Such sadness is quotidian sadness. After the graveyard shift, black and brown nurses in gray and pink scrubs wait together at Valerio's City Bakery in order to order silogs and catering. And some of us over-theorize solidarity. In the middle of East 8th, large crows swoop on the carcass of an adorable dead possum. And across the street, I see His and Hare's Barbershop. And I believe whoever named this business should win the most prestigious of literary awards. And somewhere at work, your wrists and your lungs ache, and your neck cramps, and you may be coughing and weak with fever, all inside this throb, this rot of racial capitalism. You and I desire nothing short of the unthinkable. You and I desire nothing short of the unthinkable. You and I desire nothing short of the unthinkable. You and I desire nothing short of the unthinkable. You and I desire nothing short of the unthinkable. You and I desire nothing short of the unthinkable. You and I desire nothing short of the unthinkable. You and I desire nothing short of the unthinkable. You and I desire nothing short of the unthinkable. You and I desire nothing short of the unthinkable. You and I desire nothing short of the unthinkable. You and I desire nothing short of the unthinkable. You and I desire nothing short of the unthinkable. You and I desire nothing short of the unthinkable. Invention of failure. Failure of maybe. Maybe of project. Project of surplus. Surplus of forever. Forever of play. Play of distance. Distance of regard. Regard of worth. Worth of excess. Excess of pretext. Pretext of pause. Pause of return. Return of land. After you revolt, you return. You mute. You make permutations of afterlife. Same shipfire fabulous. Same antagonism. Same dawning. Same graffitied prayer. Same thick gesture. Such solidarity. Such concrete bus rider monologue. Mark such lawless friendship whose blood stays tenement fire. Whose laughter melts marrow. Whose vigor. Whose intention. Whose lungs. Whose regard for whom poetics seems refused. Seems worth it, worth this traffic, this devalued affinity toward an exacting neverness of capital, of nothing, of nobody, of nowhere, a citation of a strange body, a non-propertied space for words run amok, words run rampant, words against rampart, words against borders, words for what we do, for what has been done to us, to make mourning, to scratch this lit architecture, this swap meet slender, slack burden, blow, blow, this unbuilt history, you and I, fake rare confidence, you and I, train strange analytic, you and I, ghost backfire migrations, you and I, exhaust calm faith, you and I, tense firecracker past, you and I, break lack syntax, you and I, grammar this turn, you and I, tender such rapture, you and I, sweet talk geography, you and I, monster most futurity, you and I, compute lost glory, you and I, wildfire soliloquy, you and I, flea market friendly, you and I, wreck what archive. I ask about what falls away. I ask about where water sings. Here is surplus of sun, ocean of excess, remaindered song. Whose hands wash this sky? Who drains this sun against worry? Whose mighty ache makes history? This is where water drains, where gardens grow against worry, against the throb and rot. And the throb and rot knows nothing but the veil hiding hand from profit. Here is leftover rice and the wild imaginary of hunger. Here is a canal in the crook of the earth. Here is where water sings. And this is water singing us elsewhere.
Wow. There you go. Very nice. I saw Let Us Gather in that spoken word performance for a moment. I think... Maybe we'll just start after you get a sip of water. Could you tell us a little bit more about the book?
So I, a lot of different things, but I, if you look at the very end, there's an afterword by a very important scholar in a lot of different fields by the name of Professor Nefertiti Eczemtadiar. She has this book called Things Fall Away, and it's about sort of reading, I guess in some ways, the life worlds that sort of don't exist, that aren't sort of necessarily legible within dominant frameworks of capital, right, and capitalism, right? And so she sort of sees a lot of revolutionary potential from there, and so she offers up ideas like divine grief or radical grief. I was sort of becoming very, very intimate with that book when at the beginning of this pandemic, in the spring of 2020, we couldn't go back to our offices. I had just moved to San Diego. We were living in City Heights, and I needed a way to process. And so I started just sort of writing up fragments, looking at old writing, and then just sort of treated the book like a reading exercise, right? So in a lot of ways, you know, there's a long list of notes in the back that sort of shows the language and the music that I am really paying attention to, right? And so I like to call the book a few different things. It's my love letter, my grief letter to San Diego. I grew up in Oceanside, but I spent a good amount of time, probably more time, in San Diego proper, even though it's getting real expensive to stick around here. I characterized it to the publisher like as this intimate grief manifesto, right? So it doesn't necessarily just stay in 2020 or 2021, but it also sort of brings in these moments where a lot of, I can imagine for a lot of us, we're still grieving, but in that moment when all of that started happening and we were losing people to COVID, right, loved ones to COVID here, and those of us who have transnational families, in like I had a number of mentors who we lost to COVID in the Philippines, right, and other sort of parts of grief, moments of grief were resurfacing, right, and so in a lot of ways this was a way to process that, and I think I was really instructed by wanting to process that grief, wanting to share my love for San Diego. I wrote this, of course, before I was appointed the laureate position, but it also gave me an opportunity to write a homecoming for me, right? The great Caribbean poet Aimé César has this sort of notebook, Return to My Native Land, and I sort of sat really closely with that book as well, and thought about the long form, right, and what that meant and what it allows, right? I'm going to assume some folks don't believe it's a long poem, but I can guarantee that the through line is grief, right? The through line is sadness. The through line is, in my view, the radical potential, the political potential, the imaginative possibility for an alternative future within that grief, right? And so it's definitely a book of ideas, but it's definitely equally a book of really attending to the failures of the English language to capture our grief, but also trying to reimagine what those grammars could be to much more accurately depict what it is we were processing. And I think it's a very sincere, very humble attempt to grieve within these and without these and beyond and within the structures that I believe were so responsible for the loss we experience and the violence we continue to experience in that, especially in that moment, right? As we know, what happened globally, what happened certainly in the U.S. in 2020, in the summer of 2020, and that's sort of second major iteration of BLM, on the Black Lives Matter movement, but also other things that were sort of many other issues that were happening transnationally. And that's a lot, right? But yeah.
Yeah, so I think like something that stands out to me as I listen to you read tonight is that the spoken aspect of your work meshes with the written aspect. This book is laid out in a very interesting way, mm-hmm. right? And so as you read it, it engenders an experience. This might be asking you to reflect as a poet, but could you talk a little bit more about how those two things work together?
Actually like talking about this than I like thinking about this stuff than I like writing. Right? I hate writing. but process. I'm a hugely into process, and so I encountered poetry here at UCSD as a college student. I guess I took myself a little bit more seriously as a poet, as a spoken word artist. I remember there was an Asian American spoken word group named I Was Born With Two Tongues, who was really active in the early 2000s, to date myself. And I remember they were bringing, one of the Asian American student organizations was bringing the Two Tongues, who were like our idols, to the pub when the pub was here. I'm still sad that the pub is not here. And they were on the stage, and so they asked if I wanted to read. I had just started writing. And so I was very much informed by what they were doing. I grew up listening to hip hop. Hip hop music and sort of in me making sense of my growing up, spoken word by like Two Tongues really sort of inspired me. And so we opened up for them. We started a crew called the Freedom Riders, which is not the movie. It was different. We were actually all student activists, advocating for a variety of things on campus. And we just so happened to gravitate towards poetry. And so what I like to say is that poetry became the language to accompany our work in the community, our love for the community. And so I think in terms of process, I think about a lot of different registers as a teacher, as someone who is a big fan of performance, not just spoken word, but music, like the music of syllables coming together, right? And sort of really thinking through all of the many traditions we have in front of us that from, our literary ancestors who've sort of made, the kinds of experiments and the kinds of the playfulness, as much as it's a heavy book of a lot of heavy grief, there was something joyous and joyful about playing with language in the way that I do in this book. And so I write, I'll read aloud, I'll look for syllables to put together. Because it's a reading practice for me, or it's also reading and writing are come together. I would add to that performing sort of informs that as well. And so as I sort of get to my process, I mean, this book, I had fragments, I was putting them together. I remember taping a long strip, like the whole poem, across my office floor, and then going back to some of the scholarship and some of the other poetry and music and other writings that were informing what I was doing, cutting those out, taping them to the sides, right? And then eventually transcribing it all, then performing it for my partner, even if she didn't want me to. She did, right? She's very supportive. And then just sort of sitting with it and knowing that writing and reading, I have a dear friend who's a dear friend of a few of ours in this room, Yumi Pak, who's Dr. Yumi Pak. And we often would, when we were working together at Cal State San Bernardino, we would often talk about the vocation of reading or the practice of reading as not necessarily something that we do to only understand. Right. And so when we're not just reading to comprehend, right, we might be reading to feel. Right. I know that there's probably some things here that feel super abstract, but they probably feel really concrete. Right. I know that because I was very intentional and intimate with how I selected, what would go together and sort of what would afford me the kind of not just the response that I assumed readers would have, right? But what would afford me a kind of feeling where I felt I was giving of my full self to the relationship between reader and writer, right? Rather than sort of thinking I'm smarter than the reader or that I had to teach or I mean, you read a lot of literature where the author is incredibly condescending to the reader, right? And so I really sort of had to sit with myself and think, okay, as I sort of am communing, or as Toni Morrison likes to sort of depict it, like my imagination and the reader's imagination, our minds are sort of dancing with each other. What does that look like, right? What does that look like sonically? What does that look like? What kind of images do I want to ensure that are there, right? And certainly, like I said, there's the whole piece. It's a sort of a magical realist piece, I guess you could say, about Miramés Boulevard. Right. And I didn't get abstract there. Right. Because I was like, we're going to go to Miramés Boulevard is going to make it in a piece of literature today. Right. That City Heights alley behind 49th and the sounds and the homie that we bought masks for, burritos for. We bought bottled water, made sure he was OK. He made sure we were OK. Right. That his speech, what he had to offer and teach us about survival, also had to make it into this book, right? And so there are a lot of ancestors in this book. And by ancestors, I mean the people that we've lost, but I also mean the thinkers, the writers, sometimes they're not explicitly listed in the notes, but they might be folks who had a way with language that was so musical that undeniably it became an organic part of how I sort of process language.
Okay, I'm going to pick up on that passion. in front of Geisel Library, we have the silent tree, mm-hmm. and that's where student activism happens mm-hmm. on our campus, at least now. And you said it a couple times. I think you just said you stormed this building
yeah.
as a student. Yeah. So maybe could you talk a little bit more about your experience as a student, how that led you into poetry?
Yeah, absolutely. I remember coming here. I am a child of two Filipino immigrants. My mother is a retired nurse. My father is a retired janitor. And I grew up, I think I might have mentioned, I grew up in Oceanside. Coming to the university was, I don't think culture shock explains it. especially knowing that, like, my homies, my friends, some of my dear friends didn't go to college, right? Some of my cousins didn't go to college. Neither of my brothers went to the university, right? And so, you know, being a first-generation college student was a tricky thing to navigate on a campus like UCSD. I quickly found a home in a lot of different spaces, a lot of different places, like the Cross Cultural Center, where I'll be reading tomorrow as well, and mentors and people like Edwina Welch, Dr. Edwina Welch, Nancy McPusau, at the time, Charlene Martinez, and other folks, and grad students and faculty in ethnic studies, right? And really sort of finding community. And I think, the sort of first thing that I gravitated towards, or the first sort of need, was to gravitate towards fellow Filipino folks, right? And so there's a Filipino organization, a mainstream organization here named Kaibigang Pilipino, which means Filipino friend. And they do, I don't know how they are now, but at that time it was a social club with some political leanings. I became very involved with that organization, but at that time, that organization was a part of a larger formation called the Student Affirmative Action Committee, right, which is SAC, right? And so SAC was our sort of, our way to sort of build solidarity with other student of color organizations, right? And so I remember some of the first campaigns we were fighting for were, very close to home. They were for justice and educational justice, right? So one of the things that we were driving up and down California at all the UCs and sort of meeting with different students and trying to get two incredibly damaging policies repealed called SP1, Standing Policy 1 and Standing Policy 2, right, which got rid of affirmative action at the university, right, before Prop 209, right? And so symbolically, we wanted to get those policies repealed. We at the time, I believe we had embarrassing figure of like 2 or 3% Black students, 1%, less than 1% Native students, and we sort of gravitated wanting to see, you know, many of us were coming out of these working class communities of color around San Diego, and we wanted to see that reflected in the university because we know we had smart folks and many of you know if you're a part of UCSD or not, you don't necessarily have to be smart to be here. I can say that confidently, right? But I think we had folks who were very capable of getting an education here if they wanted to, but for many different factors and many, many different series of circumstances, conditions, and impacting their resources couldn't get here. Right, and so we were really sort of thinking about that with SP1 and SP2. But then the other campaign that I really, really gravitated towards was the Justice for Janitors campaign, right? And that was with the Students for Economic Justice, And we were working with the union that represented custodial workers on campus. For me, this was very close to home, right? Of course, my father was a janitor, right? We knew their working conditions. I mean, we were walking around. See, these were our uncles, our aunties, our tios, our tias. They were cleaning up after us, right? And to know that they were facing, and I guarantee still facing harsh labor conditions here at UCSD, right? It sort of was a call for us to really figure out what our education meant to us, right? And so all of that energy, sort of internalizing that, studying outside of the classroom, eating pizza and whatever we could afford, right? Charging up on our student, those of you UCSD students, you can charge on your student ID and then pay for it later. I'm still paying for my loans, right? So we were gathering and really developing our political voice, right? And I remember going to a grassroots organizing weekend around Philippine liberation in LA, and there was a young Filipina student there who was in college. I think she came out of college in the Philippines. She was like 16, 17 years old. And I remember as in a workshop, and we asked, like, what is the purpose of higher education? Right? And she came out as this person who came from the Philippines, and she said, it's a space for us to develop our political voice, right? And all of us American kids were like, you're right, that's right, I've never heard that in that way. And so I think as we were developing our political voice here, working on SP1, working to repeal, you know, working on affirmative action for students, working on justice for janitors. I mean, we were basically trying to get a living wage for janitors. At that time, it was $11 an hour, right? That's all, right? But the politics around that, the negotiation, the bargaining, the lack of, like, treatment of respect and dignity that our elders were facing on campus was heartbreaking, right? And so it was that. And then, you know, shortly after 9/11 happened, and it was a tragic moment for all of our communities in very different ways. For the Filipino community, we were worried a lot about our families being deported. The airport, if you go to the San Diego airport, you'll see a lot of Filipinos working as airport screeners. We were talking to them, right? And so all of that, we were having this discourse. We were having these sort of very meaningful, we were building these very meaningful relationships. And the soundtrack of that was poetry somehow, right? The music of language, right? And then we took that up, and a few friends of mine, we brought that group together, that group, the Freedom Writers, and we performed at stages, at events, but I think maybe some of the most important performances were at actions and protests, right? We sort of really started to understand what poetry could mean in those spaces, right? And so it's never been, for me, it's not that, like, I think some folks ask me, like, you know, are you a political poet? I was like, I don't know what else there is, right? I think that I understand that language is always political. It's always a site of a negotiation of power. It's always a site of empowerment, but also violence and oppression, right? And so I think that being able to understand that here, I regret this. I didn't take any creative writing classes either. Ray Armantrout was here. Eileen Miles was still here, right? Quincy Troop was still here, right? So we still have a top-notch faculty in creative writing. I didn't take one creative writing class, right? I'm not saying my writing was good, right? But it was there, and it was meaningful. It was there. I knew who I was writing towards, right? And so I think, you know, again, my involvement in just sort of reading and studying and communing with different folks fighting for social justice, fighting for liberation of their homelands that aren't in the United States, questioning things like U.S. imperialism, militarism, capitalism, right, that those questions could only be much more sincerely asked, at least for me and my small circle, through the act of literature, right, through the act of poetry, through the act of trying to I guess develop an alternative language so that we, right? Because if these dominant structures give us the language for how we understand our relationships, then I think as we play with poetry and we sort of come to a different kind of grammar, a different kind of vocabulary, a different way of using language, perhaps this could redetermine and redefine, give us more opportunities to relate to each other differently, right? And this is where I think, you know, my love and my deep commitment to ethnic studies sort of comes from, and sort of knowing that there's an opportunity to build a language that is sort of organically comes out of the communities with which you struggle, right? The communities who you loved and who you are fighting for. And I think, you know, as a student, I didn't have this much clarity as an undergraduate student, but I had all of the same. I'm feeling exactly the same as I'm saying this to you now. This is how I felt when I was 20, 21, 22 years old, trying to figure out what was the best language or what was the most meaningful language, way of language for me, right, to express what it was I was thinking and feeling. And it happened to be poetry, right? And it happened to be poetry, a very specific poetry for the people, right, for the community. Yeah.
So, I think something that's really inspiring about working in higher education is you get to see, you said it, like honing your political voice. I also see students like honing their leadership skills or learning how to lead, yeah, right? And kind of, I think what's inspiring about working in a library is you get to be their partner with a student leader and like see where they go. I'm curious, what do you see at San Marcos? What do you see in students today?
Yeah, it's 20, over 20 years later. I am fortunate to have committed my intellectual and political life to a field that actually cares about us. In ethnic studies, right? It comes from us. It comes from our communities. And so that affords me to really, and it's not easy, right? But it affords me to come, to show up and hold space for students to really come into their own, and whatever that means, right? And so I see a lot of, you know, what we were experiencing in sort of watching students sort of come of age, come of their sort of political voice and stumble or have a lot of clarity and sort of figure that out. And I think that I see a lot of different kinds of initiatives and just small acts. I had a student intern who I worked closely with for the last couple of years, organize a social justice symposium on campus, and took the lead. He just graduated last year, and he was from my hometown. He's a Black trans student, incredibly gifted artist, a really, really generous and wonderful thinker. And to see that he took that up to organize a conference and to bring high schools there and just to sort of serve in that leadership, I think a lot. I celebrate that first, and I'm inspired, and I think a lot back to what we were doing as students here, right? And we were hosting high school conferences, like youth empowerment conferences for local high schools, right, on campus with like over 1,000, sometimes 2,000 students, right? That's Black Student Union, Mecha, KP, APSA. We were doing the outreach work that the university should have been doing, right? And we didn't have the skills. We didn't have none of that. We didn't even do the research. We just knew what it was like to come from these high schools. And we brought them, right? Somehow we fought for a budget to feed them, right? Knowing that some of these students were facing food insecurity, right? And so that sort of, I guess, I feel like now I'm feeling old, right? That youthful energy of like, we can do this, right? And so I try not to be a naysayer to my students now, because I think that there's a lot of work we still need to do.
Yeah, I mean, I think we see the value of student activism every day on this campus. There's so many issues.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll just transition. We'll talk a little bit more about the work you're doing now. So could you tell us a little bit about like what it's like to be a poet laureate?
Yeah, it's weird. It's really weird. I came back. I finished a PhD here in 2016. Thankfully, I found a job at Cal State San Bernardino, I mentioned earlier, in a creative writing department. And some of the work that I was trying to do there was I was trying to reintroduce the sort of questions of social justice and the core questions of ethnic studies within the context of writing, creative writing, fiction, poetry, performance writing. And I started to sort of sense and understand like that I could still do the work of using poetry to build community and to empower various communities. And so I was still doing that work in different ways as a faculty member. And then the opportunity to move back to San Diego presented itself and to be what I like to think of as my home. This is my home university, but my hometown university is Cal State San Marcos. I grew up in Oceanside. I remember when that university was being built. And there was an opportunity to build ethnic studies there. And so I applied, and thankfully it brought me back closer to family. But I also thought of what the poetry and community work I wanted to do when I got back to San Diego. We were in City Heights, and I was ready to go out, work with a lot of the refugee families and communities and try to sort of tap into my existing communities and networks and start to do free workshops for folks. And then the pandemic hit. And so at that time, I felt I was like really... I mean, we're all still traumatized, but I was high functioning. I'm not that high functioning anymore, right? And so I gathered with a collective of Filipino writers throughout the diaspora, right? Some in the Philippines, some in Australia, in Sydney, some in different parts of California, a close friend in Vancouver. And we started this little sort of experimental digital lab, right? Called the Digital Sala, right? Because my dream was to come back in San Diego and host things in my living room, right? And so we did the Digital Sala, and we got together in March of 2020. I was really bored in my office hours on Zoom, and I put a tweet out. It was Twitter back then, and people responded, and we built a virtual transnational literary festival of Filipino literature of like 30 events in April, right? And we gathered, and we didn't care about credentials. We didn't care what phase you were writing from. We just wanted to provide space for folks to grieve, provide space to raise money for folks who needed mutual aid. And I turned my classes at San Marcos into creative writing workshops and then opened them up to the, like, ultimately the world, right? And of course, there are trolls and all that other stuff, right? But, we had people transnationally, people coming in from the UK, joining us, right, in these workshops. And so that work got me really excited. And then the laureateship call came out. And I said, wait, there's a laureate? And then I learned, the great Ron Salisbury, our first poet laureate, he did an incredible job even as he was hit with the pandemic, and he worked on it virtually. But I applied to the position thinking, oh, this could expedite and put me in front of people that I want to work with, right? So this could help me build community. So it wasn't necessarily about me. I like to say that, even as I know it's an individualist position, it's an appointment for us, I think, right? Because I do care about those emerging literary communities, those communities who don't have poetry as a piece of their way of language, right? And so I apply, it's not an application, it's a request for qualifications, but it's an application. And so I applied, and I was like, well, we'll see what happens. And they interviewed, which was a conversation. It was an interview. So a bunch of us put our names in the hat. And I had been away, right? I was in LA, I was in San Bernardino for a while. And I was still building community, still connected, but I was away. So I kind of felt like I was coming through. And folks were like, who is this dude, right? And so they interviewed me, and I got to express my love for San Diego, express my love for the poetry communities of San Diego. And they didn't get back to me, and then I gave up. And I was like, oh, it's fine. I'm going to do this work anyway. I would have been doing this work anyway. And then they emailed me, and then I said, oh, shit. Here we go. I got it. And so my partner was really supportive, and it's comprised of a lot of different things. I think it's run out of the Commission for Arts and Culture, the City Commission for Arts and Culture. So they put me in front of a lot of not unsuspecting places where they're like, poetry is here. And so I have to share this story. My inaugural task, right? So I have to do like public appearances. I have to do a public project, which I'll talk about in a little bit. But my first thing was to read a poem at the Mayor Todd Gloria's State of the City address in 2023. Like, can you do it? I was like, yes, I can do it. And I thought of this book. I said, oh, it's just all sad stuff. And I just said, oh, I don't know if I can do it. And so they had me meet with the mayor's team. And that wasn't as intimidating as I thought it might be. You know, it was a lot of folks of color, a lot of queer, young queer folks, right? And so it felt familiar, and it felt like they really sought me out to be a part of their event. And I thought, like, oh, I'm not like a cheerleader for the mayor, so what do I do? And so I asked them, I said, what do you want me to do? And I'll just do that. And so they said, the person who was like leading the meeting on the mayor's team was like, do you know who Amanda Gorman is? I love Amanda Gorman. I was like, that's unfair. That's unfair. It's just unfair. I don't have, like, my outfits are not as good. My poetry, you know what I mean? She, like, and I was like, that's, and I'm like twice her age, right? I was like, I can't hype the crowd up in that way. I came back and I said, okay, what's the task here? And it was an interesting experience. I got to be there in front of all the folks, like what seemed like the entire police force, right? My wife was in the audience and was like, I think the police force is all behind me. I was like, okay, so no abolitionist stuff. It's fine. We're just get in, get out. And so what I did is I went back to this book and I cut up the poems and created a poem called We Draft Work Songs for This City. And it became a kind of remix of the book, which I add, it's at the end of this book. And I realized what I had always done as a poet was to speak to my communities, right, directly, to write to them. Not only to write about them so other folks could understand them, but to say, I'm talking to you. I see you on that corner, right? And so I read that poem. The people who didn't understand it gravitated toward the food references. I was like, it's okay. And then I had a student email me from San Marcos. He said, I took your ethnic studies intro class. And he said, and I talk a lot about workers in my poem there. And he said, I just want to appreciate you for speaking to us. He said, a lot of us come from families who don't have time to go to these events. Right? Who don't have time to go to events that are supposed to be for the community. And I thought, okay, I have to stay grounded in that, right? And so staying grounded in that has sort of shaped my work as the laureate, right? Not just with what I write, but how I'm trying to be out there to promote poetry education, connect with people, build solidarity, and really, you know, do the work of ensuring that the questions of poetry and language and liberation and social justice, poetry through an ethnic studies framework, I guess, is always put at the forefront, right? And so I do, I'm doing a few different things in trying to honor the many poetry communities and circles throughout the city and county. It's a city position. My responsibility, where I'm supposed to sort of do the bulk of my work is in within the city limits. But as you know, as I continue to keep saying, a lot of folks, especially poets, can afford to live in San Diego? No, right? And so folks have been pushed out, right, for many different reasons. And so wanting to link up with folks who are holding open mics, holding consistent writing workshops, right, and supporting the existing dynamic, very, very vibrant poetry community that has existed for decades, right, supporting them and wanting to figure out how we can continue to build space, but also perhaps more importantly for me, right, is being able to show up and introduce poetry to those communities and those spaces where they not necessarily would have never engaged poetry. Because they had always felt like me as a student, they had always felt alienated from poetry. They had always felt alienated from any sort of formal institutional use of the English language, right? And so part of my project, I have to do a signature project under my laureateship. Thankfully, I got the support of the Academy of American Poets through a fellowship specifically designed for poet laureates. And so I'm launching soon I want to call it a project, but it's more of an initiative called San Diego Poetry Futures 2024. And so from now until the end of the year, which is the end of my appointment, I'm going to be busy as hell, right? And so I start my work. There's four tracks. Basically, I'm building a nonprofit with not a real budget and just a one-person staff. But I'm also trying to pay other artists who I believe are part of this shared vision, right? And so I am doing presentations to high schools. I think I have about 13 high schools lined up from now until May, mostly talking to high schoolers who are in ethnic studies classes because of the passage of AB 101, which makes ethnic studies a graduation requirement for high schoolers. So working with the San Diego Unified School District, placing me in some of those English classes and some of those ethnic studies classes to talk about poetry and social justice, but maybe much more importantly, to model for them that someone like them, someone also who could very well be their uncle, right, is in a position like this and actually cares about their language and cares about how they want to articulate themselves into the world. So youth outreach is a big part of that. I'm hoping that leads to the first sort of youth poet laureate for the city, and we'll see how that goes. The other aspect is so there's four tracks. The other aspect is literary events. So open mics, readings, events like this with other authors. The chair of the board of Museum of Us, Ileana, is here. I'll be working with them to do some readings at the Museum of Us around the exhibition Hostile Terrain, which sort of explores the violence of migration specifically from the perspective of migrants. I'm going to be doing a poetry reading surrounding the work of Audre Lorde with folks during National Poetry Month in April at City Heights Library. So that's going to, I'll have a bunch of events like that. And then there's poetry education, right? I'm doing a workshop in April with the Majidal Center, which is a youth center for Arab American youth, especially at this time, in El Cajon, to read the work of Palestinian writers and to respond to those writers and to help them process their family histories and sort of what's going on from their position here in San Diego, but also working with other, doing workshops. I've worked with the Voices of Our City, which is a choir for unsheltered folks. And so I'm going to be collaborating with them on a songwriting workshop, which is great. And then the last track is where I want to play. And I'm just calling it a public practice track. At two different places in the summer, at Carmel, so far at Carmel Mountain Ranch Library and at City Heights Library. We'll be doing a family-friendly event where we're going to chalk poetry and just talk about poetry and sort of just gather around poetry. I want to do and folks who can make this happen at UCSD, if you know people, we're going to do a sort of traveling poetry crawl across the trolley. It still blows my mind that the trolley it comes here. I haven't even taken it yet. But I would like to, we're going to start with a reading at UCSD, maybe get down to USD, get down to a cafe out the trolley, get down to SDSU, go all the way to San Ysidro and do just these pop-up readings. I want to do that. So if you know, if you have money, you want to donate to that. I won't use the money. I mean, I'll use the money to pay other artists to read, but I want to do that. And so there's just a bunch of stuff where I feel like it's set, like laying some seeds, but also honoring the past of what folks have done, right? I think a lot to the legendary group, the Taco Shop Poets, who really revolutionized how we think of poetry and take it outside of the taco shop, outside of the cafe, bring it into the, and just pop up at the taco shop. I want to ensure that the future holds an expansive, like, our expansive ideas, right? And so it's laying the seeds for that from now until December so that in the future we can work towards maybe a center for poetry and social justice or something in San Diego or a collaborative. And it's really, you know, I really am taking this opportunity to sit in the position to facilitate what I can and to affirm what I can and just to bring us, you know, more space to develop resources for our communities, and to ensure that, you know, that not just the folks who are at the open mics, but everybody knows that there's a vibrant literary community here, and that community is welcoming to everybody, right? And I think that that's just, I think that happens, or that invitation has to happen on many fronts, right? Because I could do workshops. I mean, I know the five faculty members here sitting at that table who I went to school with, right? Where I could do workshops there all day, and I will. I'm open to doing that. But I think, you know, wanting to bring a workshop to a place that didn't know they wanted to do a workshop. So I did a reading at the Progressive Labor Alliance last year. I want to do a workshop with workers and maybe publish something with them, right? About what it means to be a worker, right, in San Diego, right? What it means to be, I'm trying to connect with Kumeyaay College to work with, of course, to work with local indigenous communities, right? And so just setting all of this in motion and we'll see what sticks in for this year, but it's sort of setting out and envisioning what a future could look like, where at some point some organization or some nonprofit organization that would have never imagined that part of their narrative campaign involved poetry, they have a whole host of poets they can call on to come facilitate some events or some kind of initiative, right? So really wanting to wrap that up, and of course the focus on the youth helps us ensure that by the time youth come to, you know, their places of work, or if they decide to go to college or decide to come to the university, that they're going to seek out the spaces of poetry because it was something that was familiar to them.
I love it.
Yeah.
Okay, that's an exciting vision, and I know we all want to travel that road with you. So I bet we have time for a couple questions, if folks have questions.
Hi, I'm Patty Mooney.
Hi, Patty.
I've been a poet for 50 years, so you're still a young dog. I was wondering, is it harder to write a grief poem for you or a joyful poem? Which is harder for you to write?
Oh, definitely a joyful poem. Perhaps because I'm not a joyful person. grief poems are like, I realized, like, I when I was here as a spoken word, or you know, I was doing spoken word, the first thing I did, I didn't put together a chapbook, right? I did an EP, right? Because I thought I was a rapper, right? I thought I was a hip hop head. So my friend, we recorded a very high quality EP, by the way, of poetry, and the title of that EP was Yesterday Morning, but morning like morning, not morning. And I thought it was really clever. You know, I was 22 years old. But it was also full of sadness, right? It's like, this is why I write. And so I think what's also interesting is that I started writing in that sort of tradition of radical grief, I guess you could call it, right off the bat, right? And then I got to my MFA program. I did a low residency MFA program in San Francisco at this school called New College of California, which is like a super hippie school in the Mission District. It was so hippie that 2 years after my graduation, it folded. It went away, right? But it was started by this radical Marxist Jesuit priest. The San Francisco Renaissance poets all came through there. Some of the professors were also the plumber. It was amazing, right? And I remember getting into my MFA program, and like folks couldn't, in the workshop, folks couldn't comment on what I was writing. I had all these obscure references to Philippine history. I had a long set of footnotes, all kinds of experimental performance. They're like, what is this? And so I sort of moved into writing fiction. And so my MFA was actually in traditional 25 to 30 page short stories about, you know, and I'm a big fan of teen movies, so about coming of age as Filipino. And those stories are hilarious. They're very self-deprecating and hilarious. They will never see the light of day. I actually, I cut some of those up, that language up, and made some poems out of it, right? But I think that I like making fun of myself. I haven't been able to do that in my poetry yet, right? Because I feel like, and maybe that's something I'm working through in wanting to really celebrate the humor in sort of the tradition of my family and my community, the humor and in that simultaneously accompanies this grief and this grieving. But it's I think there's a mental block for me. I think I need a therapist is what it is. My wife's a therapist, but it's not fair for me to expect her to, I want to write funny poetry. Can you help me?
I bet we have time.
Thank you for the
more.
Question.
I'll go over here.
I'm just now introduced to you. I had no idea who you were before. And I'm actually really happy that you read your work, because that gets me to understand how to interpret it. I couldn't read it the same way without hearing your voice. You know, for me, this is like performance art.
Yeah.
And so, such as great speech writers, and I prefer to define my politics in the radicalist movement, not in the everything is okay.
Right.
You know, so I just want to express my appreciation, actually, in you having read that. So it allows me to appreciate your written word now differently, because I couldn't before. To me, it was just a word on the page. I'm trying to put my own spin on it. But when I hear you read it, I get it.
Right.
You know, so that much I appreciate.
Yeah.
And at the same time, writing between what you're writing now and in a happy, poem or poetry, you know, you'll transition into that point.
Right.
You know, because you're at this point of your evolution. And we all go through different stages as we look back, and only in our latter parts of life in retrospect, you have a different perspective than what you are living right now.
Yeah.
You know, and for that, I appreciate your talents.
Thank you. Thank you, Diego. I appreciate that affirmation. I think language is performative, right? I think there's definitely a performance part. And certainly when I read, or even when I place these words in the way that they are, the book, the piece about Mira Mesa is one long sentence, and I waste a lot of paper. It's not conscious, you know what I mean? environmentally conscious, right? But it's one long line, right? And I think I imagine that in a gallery, you know, on the bottom of the wall or on a sidewalk all the way on the route, you know, and sort of thinking about it in that way. I do want to say, Diego, thank you again for picking up on the performance. I think for a long time, we were having this debate, I think as a spoken word, you know, in the spoken word circle, we were having this debate of page versus stage and sort of, you know, what is it like on the page? What is it like on the stage? And what's the difference? And I think that it could be a generative distinction, right? But it also could be a meaningless distinction, right? I do think that I prefer to be accompany the book with you know, my voice. And so I was talking to my publisher, the great API literature publisher, Kaya Press. This is like a dream for me to publish with this press, about maybe doing a podcast or something to talk about process and to read from this book, but also maybe even just doing a recording. I am thankfully a faculty member at Cal State San Marcos, where I know they had invested hundreds of thousands of dollars on tech equipment that doesn't get used enough, right? So I'm like, I'm just going to record this over there. But I also work in film, in experimental video, and so definitely that is part of my poetics, right? And I think I come from inspired by a long radical tradition of folks who are doing like a Mary Baraka and folks who are doing work in the Black Arts Movement, and so those poets that also really understood sound and really understood voice in a way that they reclaimed, right? Instead of dismissing or the hierarchy or saying that like the page is like the number one thing, right? I know that I come from ancestors who did not. We didn't write our history or have all of our literature always written in the books, right? We don't have the same kind of archive that communities who have that kind of power had, right? And so the voice and being able to perform it live, record it, I think whenever I can accompany it, I do my best to be able to do it, right?
Well, yeah. Well, Jason, thank you so much. It's been fascinating talking to you tonight, and just a round of applause, please.